So we talked about so far about how this idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking can be useful to give masses to particles that it would otherwise be forbidden by gauge invariance. And that's important because if you try to just violate gauge invariance explicitly, you run into problems such as lack of renormalizability in the theory, which ruins the idea of having a predictive theory. So we discussed spontaneous symmetry breaking for the case of a discrete symmetry. Okay, that's fine, but it's not really what we're interested in. So we have to go beyond that. And so next we're going to consider the case of an abelian global symmetry. And we'll see what happens there. So here's the model. Let's say we have a complex scalar. Phi. Here's the Lagrangian. So what I've done from the outset is I've flipped the sign of mu compared to what we had before so that we're only considering the case where you have a broken symmetry. So mu is a mass term with the opposite sign. Okay. So we have a symmetry. So the Lagrangian is invariant under a global U1 transformation. So we have phi goes to e to the I alpha time acting on phi. It's a global transformation, so alpha is just a number. It's not a function of x. That would be a local symmetry. And as I mentioned just now, I'm going to assume that mu squared is a positive number. So we get spontaneous symmetry breaking. So what do we need? We want the potential. It's minus mu squared phi dagger phi plus lambda phi dagger phi, and then all of that is squared. So when I take the minimum, so I can compute dv by d phi, this is minus mu squared plus lambda phi dagger phi times phi dagger. And we want to solve for where this is equal to 0. I think I might have forgotten a 2. Yeah, there should be a 2 here. About that. It's equal to 0, where the magnitude of phi is equal to square root of mu squared over 2 lambda. And I'm going to find this to be the VEV divided by the square root of 2. Square root of 2 is just a normalization, which will be useful later. So here's what the potential looks like. So we're plotting V. There's two field degrees of freedom. There's the real part of phi and the imaginary part of phi. And so I should draw it like this. So let's say this is the imaginary part of phi. And this is the real part of phi. So here's what it looks like. So this potential kind of looks like a sombrero, sort of. It's called the Mexican hat potential. Excuse me. What you can see is that it's not just two minima like we had for the discrete case, but we actually have a continuum of minima. There's actually an infinite number of degenerate minima, which you can see by just following around the circle. So every point is its own minimum. And that's a consequence of the symmetry. So as you rotate phi by this phase, you're effectively going around the minimum. You're going around the circle here. All right. So let's again work in, so let's write the following. So we can write phi, a complex field, in terms of a real part and an imaginary part. So I'll write it as phi 1 plus I phi 2. Divided by the square root of 2. And I'm going to assume that only phi 1 gets a VEV. So what do I mean? So the expectation value of phi 1 will be equal to V. And the expectation value of phi 2 will be equal to 0. So this is just a choice, but I'm not losing any generality here by assuming this. If, for example, I wanted to say that phi 2 gets a VEV instead of phi 1, that would be fine. But I can just rotate with respect to phi 1 and phi 2 to rotate the coordinates such that, again, phi 1 has a VEV. So I'm not losing any generality by assuming this, but I'm just making this choice. All right, so now I want to expand the Lagrangian in terms of the shifted field. So in terms of fields shifted by the VEV. So I'll have phi 1 will be equal to phi 1 prime plus V. And then phi 2, well, I don't have to shift it at all, but let's just say it's equal to phi 2 prime, so that you know both of them have primes, and it'll look better. All right, so now I'm just going to plug this in to the Lagrangian and see what we get. So the kinetic term just looks like d mu phi 1 prime squared plus 1 half d mu phi 2 prime squared. And then I have a minus mu squared phi 1 prime squared minus lambda v phi 1 prime. And then I have phi 1 prime squared plus phi 2 prime squared. And then I have minus lambda over 4 phi 1 prime squared plus phi 2 prime squared, and all of that is squared. Okay, so I'm skipping through the algebra, but you can just go through yourselves if you just plug into the Lagrangian, which was, up here. Didn't work out. Oh, you can kind of see it. Yeah, you can see it. Okay. So you just plug into the Lagrangian, the shifted field, expand everything, and this is what you get. Okay. So the first thing is, in the original Lagrangian, we had the wrong sign term for the mass of phi. But now, once we're expanding around the vacuum, we have the right sign term for the mass of phi 1. So the mass of phi 1 prime is 2 times mu squared. This would be the mass squared for phi 1 prime. Okay. And then the second thing is that the mass of phi 2 prime is 0. So there's no mass term for phi 2 prime, so it's massless. So what is the meaning of this? Well, when you think about the potential here, if I'm expanding around a minimum where only phi 1 has a vev, then I'm basically saying the vacuum is at this point here. Now if I want to move in the phi 2 direction, you can see that you're going along this direction here, which is in the same direction which you would go in to follow the actual minimum. So there's no curvature in the potential along that direction. The potential is flat. And so it means that that degree of freedom is massless. And it's a consequence of the symmetry. If you're going in the direction which corresponds to the symmetry, then you get a massless degree of freedom. So this is a general result called Goldstone's theorem. And what it says is that for every symmetry, that is broken spontaneously, there is a massless degree of freedom. For every generator of the symmetry, that is no longer a symmetry anymore. So for every generator, that is broken. Okay. So here we've broken the U1 symmetry. U1 just has one generator, just it's abelian. And so because we've broken the symmetry, we get one Goldstone boson in the theory. Yeah? Yeah, it's only for continuous symmetry. That's right. So we didn't get that in the discrete case. Okay. So all right. So I'll just mention here we had U1 has just one generator because it's abelian. All right. So Goldstone's theorem will end up being very important when we talk about QCD. But for now, it's not really what we're interested, per se, because this has to do with global symmetries. And we want to go back to gauge symmetries, which are local symmetries. So let's do spontaneous symmetry breaking for a local symmetry. Let's see what happens there. So here's the model that we're going to consider. It's just going to be the same model as the local case, but we're just going to gauge it. So it's called the abelian Higgs model. So we have a complex scalar phi with a local U1 symmetry. So it's like scalar QCD. QED. Here's the Lagrangian. We have d mu phi dagger d mu phi. Same potential as before. Mu squared phi dagger phi minus lambda phi dagger phi squared. And then we have the field strength tensor part for the gauge boson. All right. So just I'll write down the covariant derivative. Just the usual thing. You have d mu is d mu plus I g. I'll call the coupling constant g. And then we have the field a mu. And then the field strength tensor is just the usual thing. F mu nu is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. Okay. So the model works very similar to the case of the local symmetry. Again, you want to minimize the potential. The potential is exactly the same. It has exactly the same minimum. So the minimum is where the magnitude of phi is equal to the square root of mu squared over 2 lambda. And again, I'm going to call this the v divided by the square root of 2. And the square root of 2 is just a normalization. So again, I'm going to follow exactly the same logic. I'm going to recompute the Lagrangian in terms of the shifted field. And see what happens. So we'll set phi 1 is equal to the VEV plus phi 1 prime, and phi 2 will just be equal to phi 2 prime. So everything is very similar to this case. The only new thing you have in this case is just the covariant derivative. So let's focus on that part. So we have d mu phi is d mu plus I g a mu. Now I want to plug in v plus phi 1 prime plus I phi 2 prime divided by the square root of 2. So here's what I get for the covariant derivative. So let's compute the covariant derivative squared. D mu phi dagger. D mu phi. All right. So I get a 1 half for this squared. And then I'll get, the derivative will only act on the phi 1 and phi 2, since the VEV is a constant. I'll have d mu phi 1 prime plus I d mu phi 2 prime. And then I'll have this times all of these different terms. And so I'll have I g2 a mu times v plus I g a mu times phi 1 prime plus I g a mu times phi 2 prime. And then I have another I, so I should write a minus sign here. And all of that is squared. Okay. So let's just expand this out. I have a 1 half d mu phi 1 prime squared plus 1 half d mu phi 2 prime squared. OK, so those are just the kinetic terms for phi 1 and phi 2. Then I have some cross terms. So there's no cross term between this and this, because it'll end up getting canceled when you take the square. But we do have a cross term between those two things. And so we'll have a g times v times a mu d mu phi 2 prime. OK. And then we have this term squared. So it'll be g squared times 1 half times v squared times a mu a nu. And then we'll have a bunch more terms, which will all be interactions, because they'll be cubic and quartic terms in the field. So I'll just write that as dot, 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 where I just mean cubic and quartic interactions. Yeah, yes, thank you. Thank you very much. That's right. All right. So the key thing to notice is that this term pops up. This is a mass term for the vector field. So we have a mass term. For the vector field A mu, and the mass of A is just G times V. So there we go. This is how spontaneous symmetry breaking generates a mass for the vector field. But it's kind of confusing because we have this term here as well. And we're not really sure what to make of this term because it's kind of a mixing between the kinetic part of phi 2 and A mu here. So what we want to do is do a field redefinition to get rid of that term, and then everything will be straightforward in terms of interpreting the fields.
Isn't that just the current? Do you want current?
Yeah, effectively it is, because we're breaking the U1, what we want to do is put everything in sort of canonical normalization, and so we have to get rid of this. Okay, so let me just see, right? Okay, let's get rid of the A mu, D mu, phi 2 prime term. Okay. Oops. All right. So, we computed this Lagrangian by expanding the field in terms of the real part phi 1 and the imaginary part phi 2. That's like expressing phi in Cartesian coordinates, but it's a lot simpler to express it in terms of polar coordinates, so in terms of the magnitude and the phase. So let's do that. So let's expand instead of the real and imaginary parts or components of phi. Let's use polar coordinates. So what would that be? So we have phi of x is equal to the magnitude, which I'll write as 1 half times the VEV plus a field, which I'll call H, because this will end up being something like the Higgs in the standard model. And then I have the phase, which I'll write as I times another field, C, and then divided by V. Okay. And for small values of the field, you can expand. You can just Taylor expand this part. And so let's just do that. 1 over square root of 2. And we have a V plus H plus I times C. So H and C are very similar to phi 1 and phi 2 prime in the limit of small field. But this is just a different way to parameterize it. But of course, the physics doesn't depend on this. I'm not saying that it should be small. I'm just saying that if you take the limit that the field is small, you can see very easily that this is phi 1 prime and this is phi 2 prime. But if you go to higher order terms in the Lagrangian, then there will be differences between this parameterization and this parameterization. But the physics doesn't care about that. It's just a choice. OK. So now let's do a gauge transformation on phi. So we'll say phi of x goes to do a gauge transformation, I just multiply by e to the I times some function. And let's take that function to be exactly what we would need to cancel out this part. So we'll take it to be minus I C over V times phi. Right, so I can do this. And now this, of course, this part just cancels out this part. And so now I have just 1 over square root of 2, b plus h of x. So using a gauge transformation, I can write phi as just a real number instead of a real plus an imaginary part. So it's phi is purely real. And this is called a unitary gauge. Because I'm doing a gauge transformation to fix the form of the field, I've made a choice about the gauge. But we also need to transform the gauge field as well. So we also have A mu goes to some other field, A mu prime, which is just A mu plus 1 over G times V times D mu times C. Okay, so let's write down again the covariant derivative. This is d mu plus ig a mu acting on phi. And then after we do the gauge transformation, I can write this as 1 over the square root of 2. D mu plus ig a mu prime. And then that is acting on v plus h. Okay. So the other thing you can note is that under the gauge transformation, f mu nu is, of course, invariant. And so I can write this as just f mu nu. Like this. But I could also introduce the primed fields here as well. Because the extra term here, of course, won't contribute to the field strength tensor. And so I can write this as just f mu nu prime. And then lastly, the potential will only be a function of v plus h. Since the potential only depends on phi dagger phi, and we've rotated away the phase of phi, of course, it's only going to depend on the magnitude of phi, which is this. So I should also put a 1 over square root of 2. All right. So at the end of the day, nothing in the Lagrangian will end up depending on C. It's totally gone. So we've eliminated the field C by absorbing it into the gauge fields A mu prime. So now we can drop the primes. And the Lagrangian is, we have the the covariant derivative term, which is just d mu plus I g a mu acting on v plus h squared. We have the potential. So the first term is mu squared over 2 v plus h squared. Then we have lambda over 4 v plus h to the fourth. And then we have f mu nu. All right. And let's expand out the Lagrangian. So we have 1 half d mu h squared. We have a 1 half g squared v squared a mu a mu. We have plus g squared v a mu a mu times h. We have 1 half g squared h squared a mu a mu. Okay, so that's what you get from expanding the covariant derivative part. Then we get minus mu squared times h squared. And then we get more interactions of h. We have a minus lambda v h cubed. We have a minus lambda over 4 h to the fourth. And then we have a minus 1 fourth h mu nu, f mu nu, f mu nu. Now I've used the fact that v squared is equal to mu squared over lambda to simplify the expression. OK, so at the end of the day, this is what you get when you just expand all of this and then use this relation here. So it's not too complicated, it's just some algebra. All right, so now we can read off what the masses are of the various particles. We have the Higgs. So mh squared is just equal to twice mu squared. And then we have the mass of A is just equal to g times v. Everything from this term on, sorry, this term here, and then this term and this term are all interactions. So let's just look at the interactions. We have g squared v a mu a mu h plus 1 half g squared a mu h squared. And then we have minus lambda v h cubed minus lambda over 4 h to the fourth. So the key thing to note is that the interactions are not independent parameters. So it's not like every single operator that you're writing down has its own coefficient, because it's not allowed. So that's the consequence of spontaneous symmetry breaking. That reflects the fact that we started with a theory that was invariant. And although we're breaking the symmetry, the parameters of the theory respect or have like a hidden knowledge that we started with a symmetric theory to begin with. For example, the coupling of the Higgs to the two vector bosons is totally determined once you know the mass of the vector boson and once you know the VEV. Right? The other thing to notice is that there is no massless Goldstone in the theory, right? It's different than the case where you had a global symmetry. So people call this the would-be Goldstone boson. which would be C in this case, is not there. And people say it has been eaten. By the vector field, A mu. We absorbed it into A mu, right? And we can see why this had to occur just by counting the degrees of freedom. So when we started out, we had a massless A mu, which has two polarizations. And so there's 2 degrees of freedom. And then we had a real scalar, which was 1 degree of freedom. And this would have been the Goldstone for the theory with global symmetry. But now it gets eaten to form just one field, A mu, which is massive. So we have a massive A mu, which now has 3 polarizations, and so there's 3 degrees of freedom. So the Goldstone boson that we would have gotten becomes the longitudinal polarization of the massive photon, which is not there for the massless case. All right. Okay, so any questions on this? This is how you give masses to gauge bosons. Now, yeah?
If we use just phi 1 prime and phi 2 prime to get expansion,
yeah,
we will just get that extra term. But why can't we just put it as an interaction?
Which term?
That A mu and derivative mu
of phi. Oh, why can't you just treat it as an interaction? Yeah. So because it's quadratic in the fields, it would sort of affect the propagator itself. And so you kind of need to sort of re-diagonalize effectively to get rid of it.
Oh, okay. Oh, then you get the method.
Yeah. And so that's what we've done. And I would say there are other ways to eliminate this term without going through this exercise of going to unitary gauge. This is the simplest way to see what happens, but it's not the only way to do it. There's another choice, which goes under the name of arc-C gauges, which is another way to eliminate this term in the theory. But I don't think we'll talk about that. OK. So we gave masses to the gauge bosons. But there are other masses to worry about, the masses of the fermions. Those were also forbidden by the gauge symmetry. And we know in nature that that fermions do have mass. So we want to figure out how to deal with that. So let's add a fermion psi to this model. And what I want to do to kind of mimic the standard model is that I'm going to assume that psi has chiral couplings to the gauge field. All right. So we argued last class that the mass term psi bar psi is forbidden. But we can generate a mass via spontaneous symmetry breaking, similar to the gauge bosons. So first, let's just do a little bit of notation. What we need to know is we have one gauge field, but the different fields have different charges. And so let's just write down what all of the different charges are, just so we're clear. So we need to specify what are the quantum numbers for the fields. So we have three fields to worry about. We have phi. And I'll write the charge of phi as q sub phi. In the previous example, we just chose this charge to be 1. So its charge under the field was just g. And so you could think of q as the charge of phi in units of g. OK. But we have other fields as well. We have the left-handed field, psi left. And so that will have its own charge, q left. And we have psi right, which has another charge, q right. And so what I wrote before with g left and g right, so g left would just be equal to q left times g, and g right would be q right times g. OK. So the q's are just the charges of each of the field, but in units of the gauge coupling. OK. And by assuming that the couplings are chiral, I'm assuming that these two things are not equal to each other. So we have a chiral theory where q left is not equal to q right. So that's just what I'm assuming. If they were equal, there would be no problem with writing down a mass term. OK. Yeah, phi is a complex scalar.
Oh.
It's the same as the complex scalar we had before. But now we're just adding a fermion. And it has two components, left and right. And I'm assuming that the left and right-handed components have different charges under the gauge field. And so I want to parameterize that as there's only one gauge coupling, which I'm calling G. But each of the fields has a different charge. It's like saying that they all have different electric charges in units of the fundamental electric charge E. Is it clear what the model is? Yeah? OK. Let's just remind ourselves what the gauge transformation is. Phi would go to e to the minus ig times q phi times a function alpha of x times phi. And then the left and right-handed fermions will go to e to the ig times q left right times alpha of x times phi. Oh, sorry, psi. All right. So let's just write down the model just so we're clear. We have the d mu phi squared. We have the potential. We have the field strength tensor squared. And then we have the stuff for the fermions. So it's plus psi bar I d slash times psi. And there's no mass term. OK. But that's not the only term. Those are not the only terms we can write down, depending on the charges. So there's one special case where if the charges are just so, you can couple all three of these fields together in a gauge invariant way. So let's assume that that's the case. So I'll assume that q left is equal to q right plus q phi. So the charge of the left-handed fermion field is equal to the sum of the charges of the scalar and the right-handed fermion. OK. It has to be true in order for what I'm saying to hold. If this is the case, I can write down a Yukawa coupling. Yukawa just means a coupling of a scalar to fermions. And that coupling is as follows. So I have a coupling constant, y. And I'm just introducing a minus sign for convention. But then I have psi left, psi right, and then times phi, plus the Hermitian conjugate. So y is the Yukawa coupling. Just a number. It's dimensionless, right? This is dimension 3/2. This is dimension 3/2. This is dimension 1. Y is dimensionless. All right. So you can see that it's invariant under gauge transformations because so we have psi left, psi right, phi. It will just go to the same thing, psi left, psi right, phi. And then we have an e to the ig. And then we'll have q left minus q right minus q phi. OK? And I've assumed that these are all equal, so this will just give you 1. And then I just have psi left, psi right, times phi. OK. All right, so now we have this whole story of spontaneous symmetry breaking. We're going through exactly the same procedure of writing down phi in unitary gauge. We eliminate the would-be Goldstone boson. Doesn't affect anything about the fermions. But what we can do is now rewrite this term in terms of phi in unitary gauge. It's an assumption. If it doesn't hold, then there's just no way to write down this mass term. So it's not something physical. It's just a way of constructing the model to generate a mass term. If in the standard model there would be no way to write down these types of interactions, there would be no way to generate masses for fermions. And so it happens to hold in the standard model that we are able to write down these terms. But it's more of a phenomenological question where you would say, OK, can we construct the model in this way? And the answer is yes. So it's a choice that depends on the model itself. Yeah?
That assumption about summing the charges is just so that this guy here holds. But if it doesn't work, you could just rescale.
No, you can't rescale. I don't see that you could.
Because there's a very precise, specific hypothesis that I don't see why it should hold.
In general, if you just wrote down a theory of 2 fermions, psi left and psi right, and a scalar, in general, it doesn't hold.
Right. So this is very artificial, just for the model.
No, it's not artificial. This is the theory of nature. It's the opposite of artificial. This is not the theory, but it's a toy model for the theory. So maybe a better way to frame it is this is one way to generate masses if this holds. So if maybe we should write this to make you guys feel better. Oops.
Hello.
Oh yeah. Okay. Does that make you feel better? If we assume that this is true, then we can write down this extra term. Now, in a unitary gauge, the Yukawa interaction would be minus y. And then the field phi goes to v plus h. And then we have psi left, psi right. Plus Hermitian conjugate just means we have plus, oh, sorry, there's no bar here, psi bar right, psi left. And all of this is just psi bar psi. So at the end of the day, we have minus y times v, psi bar psi. And then we have 1 plus h over v. So this is the mass from the 1. And then we get another interaction between the fermions and the Higgs. So So the mass of the fermion is just y times v. All right. Sorry, there's a square root of 2 that I forgot. So it should be like this, and over square root of 2. Is there a question? Before we introduced the fermions, we showed how to fix the gauge. So it doesn't affect this part of the story at all. Because the operator is gauge invariant, it won't matter.
Oh, the unitary gauge to fix the phi?
Yeah, so the operator is gauge invariant, and so we're free to choose any gauge. So we can just plug in the expression for the unitary gauge here. Let's see, is that true? No, it does depend. So it does change. Let's see if we have to absorb something into psi. Yeah, you might have to also absorb that phase as well into the field by redefining the fermion fields as well. I haven't thought about that. So I think, let's see. So if you start out with the original gauge, so you'll have e to the I c over v, and then you'll have v plus h over the square root of 2. Let's see. Yeah, so I think that's true. So if you do redefine phi to eliminate this, then you also reintroduce it here. But then you can redefine the fermion fields as well to absorb that phase. You're free to shift those as well. So that's fine. But so yeah, you do need to do this extra step. All right. Okay. So now I just want to tie it back to this issue of renormalizability. So we've shown how you can get terms in the Lagrangian that appear to be not gauge invariant from a theory that is gauge invariant through spontaneous symmetry breaking. And you can generate masses for fermions and vector bosons. We also showed that you run into problems with renormalizability, because when you try to compute one loop endpoint functions, you end up getting divergences, which you have to absorb into counterterms, which are not present in the original theory. So you need to introduce new operators, which weren't present in the renormalizable theory. So what I want to argue is that in this theory, you can also solve this issue of renormalizability, in that there are no new divergences that crop up. So again, we're not actually going to do a calculation, but I'm just going to show it's plausible that the cancellation can occur, right? So let's consider this example again, which is psi psi to psi psi scattering. And we're considering it at one loop. And so what we did before is consider this process here. So I'll just write the momentum k that goes around like this. And we introduce this other diagram here, where now k is going like this, and it would go like this through these lines. And how does this scale? So I'm just going to worry about the couplings, the masses, and the divergences. So we have four gauge interactions, and so it will scale like g to the fourth. Then we have a momentum integral, d4k over 2 pi to the fourth. We have two fermion propagators, which I'll just write as k slash plus the mass of psi, and then over k squared. There's also a minus m psi squared here, but I'm only going to consider the leading terms that blow up as you do the integral. And so I have two fermion propagators. And then I have the propagators for the massive gauge bosons, which I'll write as k mu, k nu, over ma squared. And then there's also a 1 over k squared minus ma squared. And so again, I only need to consider the k squared part that goes as k goes to infinity. And this is squared. So this is very hand wavy, but I just want to give you a flavor of what's going on. What I argued before is that the terms with the k slash here are the leading terms that will blow up. But because you have a minus k here and a k here, those parts will end up canceling out. All right? Then you'll have a cross term, which is k slash times m psi. That term will also end up canceling out just based on symmetry of the integral. And then the leftover term will depend on m psi squared. So this will go like g to the fourth, m psi squared. So this part I can just neglect because it ends up canceling out. It cancels. It's not that it's negligible, it just cancels. And we're left with a term. So this goes to 1 as k goes to infinity, and then I have 1 over k to the fourth. And if I integrate it over k4, d4k, I'll get a log divergence. So I'll have a log of lambda squared. And then I also have a 1 over ma squared. All right. Now, in the spontaneously broken theory, this is not the only contributions we have. If you just tried to write down a theory with a massive gauge boson, again, you'd run into problems. But now that we're breaking it spontaneously, we have other degrees of freedom in the theory, namely the Higgs. So we have other contributions. So let me just write down one example. We have a diagram like this, where we have a vector boson and a Higgs, like that. So that's an example. And then we have all sorts of other permutations where I swap these two things and I attach their lines at different points. So let's just say plus permutations. It won't really matter too much. So how will this scale? Well, I have g squared here. The coupling of the Higgs is not g, but it's y. So I'll have a y squared. I have a momentum integral. For this diagram, you don't end up getting the same cancellation. And so I'm just going to write the fermion propagator as 1 over k slash squared. And then again, for the photon propagator, I have just one of those. So it's k mu, k nu, divided by k squared, ma squared. And then I have the Higgs propagator, and so that will just be like 1 over k squared. All right? So this is 1. The k dependence will go to 1. And then I'm left with 1 over k to the fourth, which again will give me a log divergence. So I have a log of the cutoff squared. I have a g squared, y squared, over ma squared. This should have been ma to the fourth. Sorry about that. OK. So again, in a general theory, where the Yukawa couplings, the gauge couplings, and the masses of the fermion and the vector boson are independent, there is no reason that these two diagrams should cancel out. But in the spontaneously broken theory, there's a relationship between all these different things. So now if I write m phi as y times the vev, and ma as g times the vev, I can write this as g to the fourth times y squared times v squared divided by g to the fourth v to the fourth times the log of lambda squared. And so that is y squared over v to the v squared log of lambda squared. And this one is g squared y squared over g squared v squared, and that times the log. And this is y squared over v squared times the log. So because the coupling constants and the masses are all related to one another, you end up getting these diagrams canceling off. And we, again, we haven't shown that they cancel because it would take too long to actually compute them, but it's plausible that they do, and that's exactly what happens. Okay. Oh, I'm out of time, but I just have one more comment to make. So it's not only that the theory is self-consistent, that you started with a normalizable theory, and even though the theory is breaking the symmetry, which sounds bad, you're ending up with a theory which is renormalizable. So that's great, but there's also a very definitive prediction of the theory, which is that we needed these extra degrees of freedom to enforce the sensibility of the theory, right? We needed H around. And so that's really the prediction that we have an H. There's some physical states which you can find. So the prediction from spontaneous symmetry breaking is that we have an extra scalar H whose couplings to gauge bosons and fermions is determined by their masses. So for example, if I wrote down the Feynman rule for H coupling to A mu, A nu, the Feynman rule would just be 2 times I times the mass of A squared over the VEV, and then there's eta mu nu. And there's also H coupled to fermions. And that Feynman rule will be I times the mass of psi divided by V. So this is the prediction. We wanted to construct a theory with massive gauge bosons, and the only way to do that would be to live with the spontaneously broken theory, which requires the existence of a new real scalar state, H, which couples to the particles it's giving mass to in exactly the way that's proportional to each of their masses. All right, that's all.